Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Ladies and gentlemen, please take your seats. Our show is about to begin.
Composer John Williams was so inspired by Harry Potter that he wrote more than just a film score and more than just a few concert pieces. In 2001, John Williams wrote an entire Potter-themed orchestral suite. This is The Soundtrack Show. Welcome back to The Soundtrack Show. I'm your host, David W. Collins, and this episode is part three, our final look at the music of Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone, or Sorcerer's Stone in the U.S., a movie from 2001 based on the novel by J.K. Rowling, directed by Chris Columbus, with a memorable and theatrical score by John Williams. In 2001, John Williams told USA Today, quote, "I wanted to capture the world of weightlessness and flight and sleight of hand and happy surprise. This caused the music to be a little more theatrical than most film scores would be. It sounds like music that you would hear in the theater rather than the film." End quote. As we've pointed out over the last two episodes, this is a score that is rich in detail, almost over the top in some places, such as using strings or celesta to depict Hedwig's flight. Or using big, brassy fanfares to give us the glory of every wizard and witch's favorite game, Quidditch. And of course, the folksy, highly emotional themes for Harry Potter and his family. But we're not done yet. Like the subsequent books and movies, there is a great threat to the wizarding world in the Philosopher's Stone. And that, of course, is Lord Voldemort, the vanquished Dark Lord who is the most evil wizard of all time. And if he gets his hands on the Philosopher's Stone, he could come back to life. And like the stone's owner, Nicholas Fornell, could potentially live forever. This is the plot that is unveiled throughout the first book, as almost secondary to the introduction to Harry and his wondrous world, but important nevertheless. Before I go any further, I want to give a huge shout-out to John Williams fans over at jwfan.com, who have tirelessly worked to put together analyses of multiple film scores, including a really excellent analysis by Finnish music aficionado Mikko Ohala, who has this to say about the music for Voldemort, quote, "For the villain of the story, albeit most of the time a dark shadow looming in the background, Williams conjured up a suitably dark and menacing thematic depiction. The music for the most powerful dark wizard of all time is a brooding melody which, like Hedwig's theme, is divided into two parts, even though here the parts are so distinctive that they could be called two independent motifs. I have given these two musical ideas separate names for easier recognition in the analysis. The first phrase, Voldemort Revealed, is a dark, angular, and maliciously progressing melody, short, direct, and nearly exclamatory in its form. It accompanies his most evil deeds in the film as told by the other characters and in scenes where he reveals his power or presence. There are certainly subtle hints to the classic monster music of old in some of the more aggressive readings of the theme, as it announces the Dark Lord almost like a growling, wicked fanfare exuding imperious malevolence. End quote. Here's an example of Voldemort Revealed. Miko Ohala goes on to describe a secondary motif for Voldemort as well. Quote, the second idea, Voldemort's evil, seems to allude to the reptilian, scheming persona of the character and his evil plots. A long melodic line literally slithers forward with languid malice, winding snake-like up and down a minor scale, part seductively hypnotic, part ominously evil. It is at first used to describe Voldemort's unseen presence, and finally the character himself as he makes a bid for the Philosopher's Stone at the end of the film. End quote. Some wonderful writing from Miko Ohala. Thank you for that. These are really great complex themes, and they make their full appearances late in the film as Harry confronts Voldemort and Professor Quirrell. But wait, some of you might be saying, even in spite of those two themes, this isn't what I musically associate with Voldemort. You're saying, no, David, you've forgotten something. I promise you, I haven't forgotten. And if you're saying there's something else you associate with Voldemort, you're right. And I agree. What I've always associated with Voldemort is much shorter and much simpler. A quick three-note motif that goes simply like this. That's it. Just a minor third and then a drop to the leading tone. It's kind of spelling out a minor major seventh chord. That kind of sound, which we talked about in Psycho. But that's it, just those three notes. Bum, 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 short and sweet. But to me, really represents John Williams' skill as a filmmaker by using these short and sweet notes. This is just my opinion, but in a movie that spends most of its screen time giving us exposition, introducing us to our beloved characters, a secret magical world that we didn't know about, and the magical rules that govern the logic of the Harry Potter universe, the Voldemort plot development does indeed function like a subplot. As such, it's mentioned as a dread-inspiring threat, but then passes. Oh, what was that? Oh, it's like a threat in the background. The movie is overwhelming us with all of these details, and the best way to help us track that evil is lurking in the background, and is most likely going to catch up to us at some point, is with a simple musical phrase. We hear it throughout the first film quite a bit. We hear it in Gringotts Bank, in Diagon Alley, while we're on the moving stairs, and of course, all the way up to the final confrontation with Voldemort himself. So let's listen again to the piece that accompanies Voldemort's reveal at the end of the film. Let's listen to the three-note motif and how it precedes the other Voldemort themes that we've already discussed. There it is. And now we resume with the other cues that we talked about before. Now here's something really interesting. Miko Ohala's analysis from JWFan.com doesn't refer to this three-note motif as a motif for Voldemort at all, but a motif for the Philosopher's Stone itself, as it is the Philosopher's Stone that is the mystery MacGuffin of this entire first movie, and we come to realize that it's tied to the potential return of Voldemort, as it could bring him back, which is why everyone's working so hard to hide it before ultimately deciding to destroy it. When I read that, I thought, wow, that's interesting, Miko, interesting. This makes sense. Yet I would argue that we don't realize that it's a theme for the stone until maybe after we fully experience the film. During the film, it functions both as a theme for Voldemort, or at least the threat of Voldemort and the threat of the unknown, as well as the stone, which is really kind of this mystery MacGuffin. We later learn that the stone itself is neither good nor evil, but as a mystery throughout the first film, as Ohala points out, the three-note motif for the Philosopher's Stone does make sense. One last curious thing to point out about this Philosopher's Stone theme that we're talking about, this three-note motif. We first hear it in Gringotts Bank in Vault 687. That's Harry's vault. And we hear it when we see the massive amount of gold treasure that was left for Harry. When the camera reveals the gold, we hear this. Huh, that's curious. That's neither Voldemort nor the Philosopher's Stone, which Hagrid is going to pick up moments later in Vault 713. But now, this is where we really hear the three-note motif again and again and again. When he's actually in 713 picking up the Philosopher's Stone. Here's what Miko Ohala says about the moment. Quote, "All of a sudden, a new thematic idea appears as our protagonist peers inside, baffled by how he suddenly has such a pile of money of his own. Interestingly, Williams introduces here the three-note incarnation of the Philosopher's Stone motif on flute over the glinting shimmer of a mark tree as Harry sees his fortune. Perhaps here the composer draws a connection between the gold and the power of the legendary stone to turn base substances into gold. But it also works as a precursor to the music to the following scene. Horn takes over the three-note variation of the Philosopher's Stone motif as the trio, meaning Hagrid, Harry, and the goblin accompanying them, as the trio arrives at Vault 713 where Hagrid claims a small parcel. The three notes build and build and gain melodramatic weight, choir adding an icy and fateful tone and ominous significance to the small package in a very operatic way," end quote. So, looking back, it's easy to see that yes, the mystery of the Philosopher's Stone and how its fate is tied to Voldemort and Harry is perfectly represented with just three notes.
And now for a brief intermission. We return now to the Soundtrack Show.
Phew! We made it out of the darkness. One of the things I love about the early Harry Potter films is that it hasn't gotten dark yet. There's plenty of time for evil in later films. In fact, if anything, the first film feels more like a holiday movie to me than an epic battle of wizarding good and evil. You know, recently on Twitter, someone asked me if I was going to do an episode on what makes Christmas music sound so Christmassy. Well, wouldn't you know it, Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone definitely has its Christmas music moments, thanks to one or two percussion instruments in particular. Anytime you add sleigh bells to anything orchestral, it's Yuletide music for sure. Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone premiered on November 4th, 2001 in the UK and November 14th, 2001 in the US. So it definitely felt a bit Christmassy, and the music, I think, reflects this in its happier moments. For example, when the children first arrive at Hogwarts via boat, we hear this. Ah, I hear triangle and sleigh bells. Then when they first enter the banquet hall, we hear this.
We're ready for you now. Follow me.
More triangle and more sleigh bells. And by the way, though not originally written for the moment that I'm about to mention, this piece of music we just played was also edited into the reveal of Diagon Alley after Hagrid magically moves the brick wall.
Welcome, Harry, to Diagon Alley. Your quills and your ink. And over there, all your bits and bobs for doing your wizardry.
For those that are curious, the original cue that Williams wrote for this Diagon Alley reveal moment wasn't used, but does finally resume when Hagrid mentions Gringotts Bank. Back to sleigh bells. Later, after the sorting ceremony, when the banquet hall feast begins and food magically appears on the table, we hear this. There they are again, triangle and sleigh bells. And finally, the cue where Hagrid is dragging a Christmas tree through the snow, we hear sleigh bells and triangle in this piece. These pieces all have this wonderful bright movement, this major key setting that we associate with winter fun. And I think it's important that Williams and Columbus give us this brightness, this holiday shimmer, as we're seeing Hogwarts for the first time. We need this as an emotional anchor, as something to hold on to in later movies as the plot gets darker and darker and darker. This music kind of captures that magical, playful spirit of Hogwarts and the light side of the wizarding world. Like our main characters, it gives us something good to fight for later on. I mentioned earlier that a scene from Diagon Alley used a cue called Entry to the Great Hall rather than the unreleased music that John Williams originally wrote for that moment. Well, it leads me to a subject that I think is very worthy of discussion on the Soundtrack Show, and especially for those of us who really love this particular score, and that is the question of soundtrack albums versus music heard in the film. Much of what we hear in this movie cannot be found on the soundtrack album, such as the troll fight we played in the last episode. Likewise, much of the music on the album can't be heard in the film. So why is this? What's the story here? Well, very much like his other soundtrack albums, John Williams produces a listenable album experience that captures what he feels to be the essence of the music that he wrote for a film. He wants it to be cohesive. He wants it to be a pleasure to listen to, for the album listening experience to take us on a journey from beginning to end. Oftentimes, that means, in his official releases, that he omits certain pieces, edits certain pieces down, but also, oftentimes, records concert arrangements of pieces just for the album or for later live concert performances. On the original soundtrack album for Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone, there are two concert pieces of note. One of them is called Hedwig's Theme, and the other is Harry's Wondrous World, the latter really being a showcase for almost all of the musical themes in the first movie. But there's still more to this story, and this is really, I think, the heart of this episode of the Soundtrack Show. I'm excited to share this with you. For those of you that don't know this, I would like to introduce you to the existence of a 9-part orchestral suite that John Williams wrote at the same time that he wrote the movie music, and it's called Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone Children's Suite for Orchestra. In spite of production pressures and tight deadlines, John Williams found the time and the inspiration to write and record 8 musical miniatures that all deal with some part of the movie and deal with life in the magical wizarding world. Though the suite is 9 parts, one of them is the concert suite Harry's Wondrous World. So he wrote 8 more. This children's suite for orchestra is in the spirit of Camille Saint-Saëns' The Carnival of the Animals or Benjamin Britten's Young Person's Guide to the Orchestra. And it's been performed in concert all over the world. It's designed as this wonderful tour through the music and content of the first film. Some of these pieces have rarely ever been heard, but each one of them is a delight and something to look for if you're a big John Williams or Harry Potter fan. Part 1 of this orchestral suite is called Hedwig's Flight and is orchestrated for celeste or celesta, woodwinds, and strings. The recording of this is actually on the original soundtrack album, but it has been renamed to Prologue. Part 2 of the suite is called Hogwarts Forever and is for the French horn section only. We played a bit of this in the last episode as it's featured on the original soundtrack album as a track called Hogwarts Forever and the Moving Stairs. But this time I'm going to play a little bit more of it, and I want us to listen for something that immediately caught my ear when I got this album. A small fragment of Hedwig's theme can be heard in this Hogwarts anthem. Okay, this is all normal. Really nice piece. And now a B section coming right up. Wait, did I hear something? Let's repeat that again. Okay, it's just a few notes and not a full statement, but in this Hogwarts Forever theme, I heard a little fragment of Hedwig's theme. What's interesting to me about this is that this Hogwarts Forever track hints at being an in-world or diegetic piece of music. That is, a piece of music that is a reality for the characters in this story. So, that makes me wonder, is the Hedwig melody... is that melody, that famous Harry Potter theme, is that a piece of music that characters in the wizarding world are familiar with? Well, according to John Williams and the first movie, yes. Yes, it is. As proof, I give you this scene. Almost 2 hours into the film, right after Harry, Ron, and Hermione have finished their final exams, and Harry's scar is really hurting him, they end up just outside of Hagrid's hut. As they go to speak with Hagrid, listen to the piece of music that Hagrid is playing on his recorder or little wooden flute. as he's just sitting on his front doorstep.
I'd always heard Hogwarts end of year exams were frightful, but I found that rather enjoyable.
Speak for yourself. All right there, Harry?
My scar keeps burning.
It's happened before.
Not like this.
Perhaps you should see the nurse.
I think it's a warning. It means danger's coming.
What is it?
Don't you think it's a bit odd that what Hagrid wants more than anything is a dragon, and a stranger turns up who just happens to have one? I mean, how many people wander around with dragon eggs in their pocket? Why didn't I see it before? Hagrid, who gave you the dragon egg?
That's right. Hagrid is playing Hedwig's theme, there in the story, for all of the characters to hear. This plays right into the idea that the melodies in this movie all come from old in-world wizard folklore, which is such a deep world-building connection from a musical standpoint and further cements this score in the romantic style. I point this out not just because it's cool, which it is, but because we find that the lines are constantly being blurred in this score between film score and diegetic score, or source music. And this is just the first example of this in this 9-part children's suite. But let's move on. The third part of the suite is called Voldemort, which is written for 3 bassoons. It's a wonderful eerie sound, rarely heard miniature, certainly not anywhere in the film. But this miniature does contain both melodies associated with Voldemort that we played earlier, as well as the 3-note motif that we discussed, which we've tentatively attributed to the Philosopher's Stone. Though I still kind of feel like that it's at least also tied to Voldemort, as this musical miniature would suggest. Let's take a listen. Wow. What a curious and fascinating cue, especially because we know now just how bad Voldemort is going to get before the end of this series of books and films. Anyway, moving on. Part 4 is called the Nimbus 2000, named after the sleekest broomstick in the wizarding world. For time, I'm going to skip this one, but for our information, it's built around what I called the B section of Hedwig's theme. I think Mikko Halo also called this the flying theme. Anyway, moving from part 4 to part 5, part 5 is called Fluffy and His Harp. This is a really curious and wonderful miniature. For starters, Fluffy is put into a sleepy spell in the film whenever he hears music. So when our villains went down the trapdoor, they left a harp next to Fluffy to put that 3-headed dog to sleep. Now, harp is all we hear in the movie, but in this miniature, we hear the harp as well as a contrabassoon to represent the giant Fluffy. This is also on the original soundtrack album. The track is called Fluffy's Harp. Here's John Williams to tell us more.
There's a 3-headed dog who guards a secret chamber. And of course, when he's awake, nobody can get past the sleeping dog. The dog is called Fluffy, incidentally. and there's a magic harp that kept Fluffy asleep. And as long as the harp music was playing, we were safe to go into the chamber because the guard dog, the three-headed guard dog, would be asleep. Hence, the music of the magic harp, played by the harp itself, of course, and Fluffy, the three-headed guard dog, was big and threatening and ominous, characterized by the contrabassoon, which has the lowest pitches of all the orchestra, and putting these two unlikely instruments together in a sort of somnambulant duet.
Part 6 of the children's suite is called Quidditch. I'll let John Williams explain this.
There's a game that the houses of the school compete in each year called Quidditch, with towers of flags and all this atmosphere of crowd and celebration. So for music, nothing's better to characterize all of this than the herald trumpets and the brass section of the orchestra, which brings all the heraldry and the color of this kind of celebration and contest.
Part 7 of the children's suite is called Family Portrait. It's absolutely gorgeous and heartbreaking. I'm going to quote Miko Ohala's analysis here from JWFan.com. Quote, "Gentle, autumnal, and wistful sounds of solo clarinet accompanied by the sonorous singing of the celli forms a lovely meditation on both the sweeping lyricism of Harry's Wondrous World theme and the yearning innocence of Harry's family theme, showing both sides of Harry Potter's world and personality in warm and nostalgic tones. Not only does this suite show the close connection of the two ideas, almost like two phrases of the same, but also embellishes both ideas, the solo clarinet taking new and unique paths through the melodic ideas. The movement also highlights the instrumental combination of clarinet and celli, exhibiting William's skill in combining sounds that complement each other truly well," end quote. It's beautiful. The last miniature for us to cover may help clear up some confusion, actually. Part 8 is called Diagon Alley. Here's a clip of John Williams discussing this piece when it was performed with the Boston Pops.
Diagon Alley is the place in the story where the wizards go. Harry Potter goes to Diagon Alley with his mentor, Hagrid, who takes him there to equip him, to get him his equipment for his life as a wizard. And particularly, he has to pick out his magic wand and get his broomstick, his Nimbus 2000. And you see other wizards buying the magic potions and getting their witches' hats and all their gear in this fantastic cornucopia, if you like, of color and activity and sights and sounds. Well, I thought right away of forming a little small wizard's orchestra, if you like, to portray what just I imagined would be the musical part of this mélange or collection of sounds that make up the atmosphere that you can almost taste.
Original soundtrack album, we hear this piece of music in a track called Diagon Alley and the Gringotts Vault. The beginning of this track is from this children's suite and is not anywhere in the film, but it does capture the essence of a diegetic band playing in that alley. It's full-on Renaissance fair mode, and I think that's part of its charm. Unfortunately, the piece that Williams did write for the Diagon Alley reveal is, as I mentioned earlier, unreleased. And finally, the last piece in the suite, Part 9, is Harry's Wondrous World, which we've covered extensively on the show. And that is the whole children's suite for orchestra that John Williams conceived of, wrote, and recorded while working on the film score for The Philosopher's Stone. I hope it clears up some confusion about the soundtrack album versus cues from the movie. But more than that, I just wanted to share it because it was born of pure passion on the composer's part for the film, the book, and the music that he was writing. It's wonderful music and really adds another dimension to this soundtrack and the world of Harry Potter in general. I hope that someday we'll get a full soundtrack release with all of the cues recorded for the film, as well as a fully sequenced recording of this amazing children's suite for orchestra.
The Soundtrack Show will continue in a moment. We return now to the Soundtrack Show.
John Williams went on to score two more Harry Potter films after this first one, 2002's Harry Potter and the Chamber of Secrets, as well as 2004's Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban. Both of his follow-up scores are fantastic, and they add so much character and emotion to those films. Hopefully we'll be able to cover them both down the road. But there's something special about Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone. It's the score that kicked off a huge franchise and forever set a high bar for other musical entries into this magical world. To shift gears here, I want to close with a letter that I received from Bob. Bob writes, "Hi, Mr. Collins. Thanks for the soundtrack show. It's terrific, and I make sure everyone I know knows I think so." Thanks for that, Bob. "I have a suggestion for a topic on your show, recognizable style versus self-plagiarism. Anyone who knows movie music can recognize just a snatch of John Williams if they hear it, or Hans Zimmer, or John Barry, just a few examples of composers with distinctive styles. But there's another situation that sometimes arises. No one familiar with the soundtracks from Star Trek II and Star Trek III could have failed to notice passages from them quoted almost verbatim during the climax of Aliens, all scored by James Horner. This is more than Horner just having a recognizable style. Did he copy and paste due to deadline pressure, laziness, creative depletion? Maybe he was convinced that was exactly the right music for the circumstances, never mind having used it before? I don't mean to knock James Horner. He's certainly a creative genius, and I'm a fan of much of his music. But he offers the clearest example of the kind of thing I'm talking about. Where is the line between, on one hand, when two pieces of music are stylistically similar, and on the other hand, when two pieces of music are effectively the same. Thanks again and keep up the great work, Bob. Wow, thanks for writing, Bob, and you bring up a fascinating and very, very important film score question. It's one that comes up a lot, and we could talk about it for more than just one episode. We can talk about it probably at least once every episode. And before I get specific on the case of Aliens versus the Star Trek 2 and 3 and James Horner, the best answer I can offer is a general guideline that I kind of keep in mind based on what I've both witnessed firsthand in the entertainment industry as a mixer and even having written some music, and have certainly read about time and time again, and that is this. When it comes to what music is placed in the film and where, the final say, the actual final say that goes to the audience, doesn't lie with the composer. It lies mainly with the director, but even the director can be overruled by studio executives, focus testing, powerful producers, censors, etc. There are some cases where the composer is referencing previous works, like you mentioned, but oftentimes that reference may actually just be a request of the director. The director said, hey, do what you did in that one film. That's what I want. Other times, and there are some real horror stories here, movies are edited together with temp tracks, temporary music, and these temp tracks come from previous works of that same composer. It's funny that it's Aliens we're talking about, because in the case of Ridley Scott's Alien from 1979, Jerry Goldsmith's actual music that he wrote specifically for that film was ditched in favor of music that he wrote for a film years before, and he was beside himself. I actually think that the answer lies within your email when you said deadline pressure. Well, the answer is yes. Aliens was early on in both James Cameron's and James Horner's careers, and Horner has gone on record as saying it was the biggest nightmare of his career. When he arrived to begin scoring the film in London, he found that the film was still being shot. He got into a situation where he had only 4 days to finish the last cue, and even then, Cameron wasn't fully satisfied with it. So Horner had his back up against the wall with an unmovable deadline, and he stayed up 36 hours straight to try and piece together something that worked. So without context, you can see it. Yeah, it does sound like plagiarism, but once you realize the tremendous struggles that sometimes working in this business people go through, you start to see the mark of a true professional like James Horner. He didn't give up, and he delivered a score that worked, that really worked for this huge blockbuster film. It kind of leads me to another historical conversation. Unlike opera, which has been around for over 400 years. Unlike opera, where composers completely controlled the medium for hundreds of years, they were the ones that, decided who was going to write the libretto. They had control over casting. They had control over sets and design and everything. Unlike opera, where the composers had control, film music is kind of like a service that is provided to the filmmaker. There are historical reasons for why this developed this way, but it's interesting to note that the emotional impact that music has, in my mind, and then probably in the mind of a lot of you listeners that are so passionate about movie soundtracks, the emotional impact that music has kind of really outweighs the political reality that composers face when working on these projects. It's something we should keep in mind when we hear these kind of things. It's usually a result of circumstances that are beyond the composer's control. Thanks for your email, Bob, and I hope to go more in depth with your question and with the Alien and Star Trek franchises in future episodes. Thanks so much also to all of you who take the time to write or post on social media. I read every single one. Please reach out and let me know your thoughts on music, the show, any suggestions you may have, comments, etc., by emailing thesoundtrackshow@howstuffworks.com or by following us on Facebook and Instagram at SoundtrackShowHSW. Or on Twitter at SoundtrackHSW. I'm also on Twitter and Instagram at David W. Collins. Thank you.